Stan Hieronymus, the author of Brew Like a Monk, joins me for a discussion of Belgian beer styles. This is Beersmith Podcast number 205.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 205, and it's late December 2019. Stan Hieronymus joins me to discuss Belgian beer styles. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Easy. Brew big in small places with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The Brew Easy's revolutionary setup combines batch sparge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the work clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Add the optional Brew Commander for precise temperature control and mash automation. With the Brew Easy, you'll discover definitive proof that size isn't everything. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And I recently converted the BeersmithRecipes.com website to support mobile devices and also added the majority of the Beersmith brewing tools to the site. Subscribe to Beersmith 3 and access over 17 brewing tools online from any device. And anyone with an account can browse from tens of thousands of recipes. Visit BeersmithRecipes.com from your phone or computer to learn more. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Stan Hieronymus. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops and has authored a number of other books, including Brewing Local, Brew Like a Monk, and Brewing with Wheat. Stan has also penned hundreds of periodicals and is a certified beer judge. Stan, it's great to have you back on the show, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and thanks for continuing to ask me to come talk about beer.
Yeah, you were on not that long ago with John Palmer doing a Q&A session. That was kind of fun, but you been doing anything since then? I think you had some trips, right?
Yeah, more family trips, not nearly as much as Palmer's doing. He's like in South America every other week, I think. But a few trips to various parts of the U.S., mostly to talk about hops.
Yeah. Are there any new developments in hops that we don't know about?
I don't think anything particularly since we talked last, but a lot of catching up, trying to sort out what's going on with these new varieties, the hop harvest, stuff like that. And whenever I go and talk to brewers, I'm reminded of what they don't know and or what could be done clear or what I could write or talk about in a more educational way.
Well, today we're going to talk about Belgian styles, and I've got your book, Brew Like a Monk, here, which is a couple of years old now, I think, right?
14 years.
14 years old, okay.
It's hard to believe, I know.
But we haven't covered it actually on the podcast in a couple of years either, so let's talk about first what makes Belgium such a unique place in terms of beer styles. They literally have hundreds of different kinds of beer there.
Since you'd sent me these questions in advance, I've been thinking about it. So I guess as much as anything, it's a reflection of the country itself. You realize that Belgium isn't 200 years old. So it's parts of it always been there. And individually, maybe they kept themselves separate, whether from the Netherlands or France or Germany. It's also been referred to, of course, as a country divided by two languages. So to the north, it's Flemish and Dutch. To the south, it's French. And just the idea that there's one country, but many differences, maybe that makes it easier for people to continue to hold on to those smaller regional differences. So it's not just beer, it's cuisine and obviously the way people talk. some of their attitudes, the way they dress, you know, that they're all a little bit different than each other within Belgium. When you consider the fact that you can easily get from one, it's not an end, but from deep in the Ardennes, for instance, where Orval is, to over north of West Flatrun, which is, you know, a cult brewery and a Trappist brewery, so up to Bruges, and that's less than a day travel.
Right. I mean, it's a small country, really, considering how many styles they have.
Yeah, that's and maybe they just treasure that uniqueness. Like I said, not just beer, but everything else.
Interesting. And how did so many Belgian styles survive two world wars when we saw a lot of traditional styles and breweries wiped out?
Well, if you take a longer view, as for instance, Trappist would, and you go back centuries and centuries, those world wars were relatively short amount of time. To breweries, the actual brewing operation, that did make a difference when the Germans came in and seized all their brewing equipment and like the copper and used it in the process of the war. But putting a new brewery into place wasn't quite that difficult. It's not like when you think the difference of prohibition in the United States, when you had 14 years without beer, you had almost a generation and you had 14 years of people coming of age when they would naturally start drinking beer. And obviously many people continue to drink beer. But during that period, beer in some ways was forgotten. And the wars were a much shorter period.
Yeah, I was thinking we had had a guest on recently talking about beers and English beers in World War One, and yeah, the effects of the laws that were put in place and a lot of the taxation that was put in place continues almost to this day in England. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, in the case that you can see that in England, so they lowered the alcohol level and you had a taxation level. Some of those things persisted. But they also reflected a change that was going on probably before the war, where you were already lowering alcohol levels. And in many times, in many cases, and we certainly saw this in the United States, people going to a Wonder Bread type of beer.
Yeah. Well, your book, Brew Like a Monk, focuses on Trappist, Abbey, and strong Belgian styles. But before we dive into those, I think maybe we ought to mention a few of the other distinct beer styles in Belgium. So if you could walk through a few of those.
Yeah. So you realize this is the third book of three. The first book was Farmhouse Ales by Phil Markowski, and that's Saison and Beer de Garde. And those, of course, are we primarily think in terms of the region of Wallonia, which is towards the south on the eastern side, and then the Beer de Garde down into France. The second book was Jess Barrow's Wild Brews, which, as the name suggests, focuses on the Lambic styles, and then like Flanders Red, the beers that are in intentionally soured within the brewery, or at least getting it in the wood. And then the third book was my book, which is primarily, at the time, it was basically one BJCP subset, category 18. Those styles have kind of moved around. And so now they exist in different categories, not all together. And somehow in the process of this, Belgian white beer or wit beer was just sort of fell through the cracks.
Yeah, it's become quite popular, actually.
And it was popular then.
Yeah.
And it's not exactly here. I was in a meeting, and this is when my book is literally it's finished, going through the production process, and the topic came up. We said, well, Königshaven, which is La Trappe beers, was introducing a wit beer, so maybe we could just go back and put wit beer in Brewed Like a Monk. Of course, part of the thing about that is Koenigshaven was actually not a Trappist brewery at the time. Not that that matters. They'd lost their designation for a short period of time. So a few years later, I did Brewing with Wheat, and that was an opportunity to focus much more on the Belgian white style, and you know, be several chapters of that book.
Well, your book does focus on the Trappist and Abbey styles. I was wondering if you could maybe start with a history of those styles, because they have a very rich and long history.
Yeah, well, there's two parts. They go back a long ways, obviously. Even before Charlemagne, monasteries were making beer, and then with Charlemagne and strengthening monasteries, they became more prominent. At one time throughout Europe, estimate is there were about 600 monastery breweries. That's not just in the lowlands that became Belgium.
How did that come about? How did the monasteries start becoming the center for brewing in many cases?
Well, they needed beer. You know, they made beer like they grew a certain amount of crops, those sorts of things, just like the people made beer in their own homes. So this was basically, in their case, they were home brewing at the outset. You also realize that they always opened their doors to visitors, so they were making some beer for the visitors as well. And as they grew in size, and they were also, they were the keepers of knowledge, so they collected information about brewing, and they became a little bit more advanced in that way. And some of them, those breweries sort of became if you wanted to have a commercial brewery, you could go see the footprint they had and the way they were doing it, and copy that as well. So all those things came together throughout the Middle Ages. In the case of Belgium, which we are talking about. And at the time I wrote Brew Like a Monk, there were 6 Trappist breweries. Koenigshaven / La Trappe had been Trappist. There were some concerns about their independence. So the International Trappist Association would not give them the mark, in other words, where they could trademark their beer and put the ITA symbol on it. So a period there were only 6. Well, in Belgium, Napoleon just leveled all those breweries. The beginning of the 19th century, none of the monasteries we think of as brewing now existed, or they've been totally ravaged.
Napoleon is 100 years earlier. So for 100 years,
at the beginning of the 19th century.
Okay, I'm sorry.
During the 19th century, that's when you have the monasteries reestablished. Chimay and Westmalle, that begins making beer about 1840, Chimay a little bit after that. So you have those, but they continued to change. There's a connection to the beer. So you particularly can look back at that dark brown style that we call double and think that Chimay and Westmalle made a beer similar to that in the 19th century, but their recipes continue to change. And until maybe as part of marketing, they said, this is what our beers are going to be. And they've changed very little since then. But, like the Westmalle double, they begin using sugar in the double it's after World War I, and then the triple is also invented between the war. Chimay's recipes are all written after World War II. Rochefort, which is nearby to Chimay, and had some real quality control issues. It had to do with their water source. And they actually asked Chimay to quit sending their beer over to Rochefort because nobody would drink the Rochefort beer. And the monks at Chimay suggested maybe it would be better if you learned how to make a good quality beer. So those Rochefort recipes are all from the 1950s, for instance. Even though if you visit Orval, You can go back and see ruins that are more than 600 years old. The Orval doesn't install its brewery after being ravaged by Napoleon until the 1930s. So you can see they're modernist, so to speak, but they've got a tradition of that they brewed once. The monasteries have been there a long time, but that doesn't mean that the beers didn't evolve.
Interesting. I think their brewing techniques have evolved too, somewhat, right? They have, a lot of them have fairly modern facilities now.
Almost all of them. And they certainly have modern facilities in terms of, you know, they do not have microbial issues, which you can go to other small breweries. And this is true, not only in Belgium, but when you go to small breweries in France or Germany, and they are not the cleanest places on earth.
The number of Trappist breweries has expanded since you wrote the book, I think, but they've also been pretty aggressive in protecting the Trappist name or brand, right?
Yeah, well, this was true before. I mean, even, you know, that was true in the 30s when Chimay, for instance, started defending the mark. So to give you an idea, if, as you know, Spencer in Massachusetts began making beer.
Mention a couple of the new ones because people may not be familiar with them, maybe.
Well, you've got them in Italy, in England, in the Netherlands, in Austria. And then that's all Trappist. Spencer's a Trappist. The Benedictine Brewery in Mount Angel in Oregon is Benedictine. So which are this? Trappist are a subset of Benedictine. So that's run. And that brewery is actually the monks are doing all the labor. They're the only people working in the brewery now. Spencer is much more like the Belgian model. So they have a brewing director who is a lay person, and then they have a few people work in the brewery. Although the monks are involved in, much of the process from driving forklifts to packaging and those sorts of things. But Spencer, when they began, the idea was they would make one beer. They would perfect that beer and perhaps move on. And this is makes sense if you're looking at the Belgian model, because Westmalle makes two beers, although there's actually a third one extra, but two beers that are generally distributed. Orval makes one. Again, they have a small beer. Chimay makes three. They have a small beer. Rochert makes three. So they don't make a lot of, they don't release 600 styles during a year like some American breweries do. But that model hadn't exactly worked for Spencer. So anytime they want to introduce a beer and have the ITA mark on it, they brew the beer, put together the packaging, they send out this very long description, everything about the beer, how it's going to be brewed, its background, how it'll be marketed, and so on. And that goes to a committee, and then they take the beer to Belgium and it's tasted by people. So it's like you don't introduce brands like, oh, I brewed this the other day, it's really good, and we're going to put it on tap Friday. So
they're not brewing on a weekly basis new stuff, huh?
Correct. But they have a 50-barrel brew house. But they can sell beers that don't have that mark. So they did a pumpkin beer this year, only 50 barrels, so not a large batch. And that was sold in cans. They make an IPA. That also doesn't have the ITA mark on it. So they can sell beers that don't have the Trappist mark as well.
Can you walk us through the major Abbey styles and what makes each one? Well, actually, before that, could you explain the difference between Trappist and Abbey Ales? Because a lot of people make Abbey Ales, right?
Mm-hmm. So we're about to talk about styles.
Yeah.
But Trappist is not a style. Trappist is an appellation. That means it was brewed in a Trappist monastery. And in order to have that mark, it also means that everything about the brewing process is controlled by the monks. You could have lay people doing the work, but the monks are involved in deciding what the beer is going to taste like, its pricing, how it's going to be marketed. All these are important to them, that it reflects their life, and then also what the monastery is like. The abbeys, for the most part, and there are rules to sell your beer as an abbey beer in Belgium. And in that case, some of the money from the profits needs to go to benefit an abbey, which might be an existing abbey. It might also be pretty much a pile on the rocks somewhere, but somebody benefits from that. So there is still, it may be a for profit,
and then of course here in the U.S. I think anybody can brew an abbey ale or call it an abbey ale,
right? And you can, and it has meaning. This is a tricky thing when we talk about styles, and people get upset about what's called an IPA or a session beer or whatever. If it has meaning to somebody, and hearing that name gives people an idea of what it tastes like, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so walk us through the major abbey styles and what makes each one unique from a brewer's perspective.
Well, from within the abbeys, almost all of them have a small beer. So BJCP, this is called Trappist Single. Some people call it a Pater beer.
Single, yeah.
Yeah, so it just means a lower alcohol version. But they, the case of Chimay, it's a smaller ABV beer that has a little bit of spicing. At Orval, it's simply Orval watered down, so lower ABV. At Westmalt, it's a just Pilsner malt, Saaz hops, well attenuated, and lower, like 5% gravity. And to give you an example, so that's what Westmalt is called. Extra, it's brewed a few times a year, packaged, and it's the beer that monks would drink at the table. Also the monks at Ockel would get as well. Over time they'd occasionally take it to festivals because they understand beer geeks like something unique. And it is a little bit more available now. At West Flat Run, their smaller beer falls out of all these categories. West Flat Run 6, they make two strong dark beers, which have a cult following. That's the 8 and the 12. The 6, on the other hand, is pale and very hoppy. Rochefort does not make a small beer. At Ockel, at the monastery, when you're there, the beers you can get are just, their regular beers are pretty small. Ockel 5, whether it's a pale or a dark. So that's lower alcohol. All of those together, you make a beer like that, you're going to call it a Trappist Single. There's what's referred to BJCP. Belgian Blonde, you're more likely to find that labeled Abbey beer or Belgian Blonde. That's kind of it's the strength of a double and pretty much the taste profile of a triple, although not as hoppy, obviously, as a triple, but even the balance is less hops. It's going to be like 6 to 8% alcohol, and it may not be quite as well attenuated as a triple like Westmalt, for instance, or Chimay. Then you've got the Double, which to me is the hardest of these beers to brew, just to get right. So it's that's a darker beer. It's going to have some dark. What in Belgium is considered a sugar, And you see called, but it's really a syrup, a confectionery sugar used to add some of the dark flavor. And it's also going to have a little bit of a colored malt as well. Again, going to be 6 to 8%. It can be, have a little chocolate note, like the West Malt Double, or just kind of a rounder, darker fruitiness, like a Chimay Red. Then there's the triple, which is the stronger style, which may or may not have originated with West Malt, but West Malt is the one that made it famous, and that's higher alcohol. In their case, it's 9.6%. Going to be in the high 30s in BU, and it's definitely going to have a hop presence. And likewise, you've got the Golden Strong Ale, which is very similar. And it's worth noting that those are both from the same region, the north in the region of Antwerp province. So it's a short ride from Duvel to West Malt. They both have soft water. If anything, you know, and the Golden Strong, so we think of it in terms of Duvel. It defines the style. And that's a really well attenuated beer. It's lagered for a long time, so it's you know, it's just got this real smooth quality to it. Some similar beers to that in Belgium are not as attenuated, so they're sweeter. Those beers do exist. I don't find them nearly as drinkable. And then, so that's a Golden Strong. And then you've got the Dark Strong, which some people refer to as a quad, and almost nobody did in 2005 when I wrote the book. Now more breweries do. There were a couple of U.S. breweries, and of course, La Trappe was already putting out their quad. And that's a bigger, stronger beer, like, and it can go to 11, 12%. Doesn't necessarily have to be quite that strong, and again, it's going to be lots of dark fruit character. So that's the family.
Quite a few, huh?
Yeah,
and they aren't necessarily closely related, even, right?
Well,
I mean, in some ways,
but in certainly ways, you know, what draws them together is that they are well attenuated.
Yeah.
And it's a tricky word. So in Josh Bernstein's new book, Drink Better Beer, he asked for epiphany moments or whatever, which I'm not real good at, and some longer. And I simply passed along not my own wisdom, but Hedvig Nevin, who is the director of brewing at Duvel. And when I visited there, we talked about what Americans were doing wrong. And while I appreciate it, people come up to me and they say, I really like the book. Obviously, not everybody's paid attention to this, because I'm still getting beers that have those same characters that he complained about 14 years ago, which is they need to be well attenuated. It's not as simple as attenuation. I really like his description. It's a question of digestibility. And that's what these beers have. They are digestible. They do, even though they have a higher level of carbonation than an English ale, but even something like an American IPA, they are highly carbonated, but they do not fill you up. They do not leave you being gassy, and they are super food friendly. And that's one thing that brings them together. So, you know, what you're doing, so you get that well attenuated and digestibility, and then they certainly have a lot of in the balance, they're closer to yeast forward than hop forward, even though they have a fair amount of hops because they have fairly high alcohol. So that it's that family of yeast, and while they may be different, they are they share some of the same characteristics, and that is that you can get a beer that is well attenuated. They handle higher alcohols pretty well, and they are all a shade of wild. So as we domesticated yeast, like anything that you're going to make an English ale with, and American ales, those are going to be POF, and that means positive off flavor. Yeah. POF negative. And the idea is, I mean, it's kind of weird to say it's an off flavor.
It's a double negative.
Yes. So you have POF.
They're off flavor negative.
And POF positive.
And POF is
phenolic off flavor. I said positive off. Phenolic off flavor. So they can get towards phenolic. So anytime if you went out to your yard and said, I'm going to find some yeast in the wild, they are going to be POF positive. You know, we've only got, if you look at the yeast genome, there are only two tracks where you somehow ended up with yeast strains that are POF negative. And a scientist in Belgium explained this to me, that, you know, every time you ferment, you're going to get a few yeast cells that are negative. How those were selected, like this is 400-500 years ago, how brewers happen to get that those few negative out for some strains, it's hard to imagine how that happened. But they did breed them to be the POF positive to have less impact. So it can, that's why you can, one of the reasons you can get a difference between a Hefe and a Belgian yeast. But the other part, of course, has to do with your mashing process.
Well, central to many of these styles is the use of candy sugars, of course, which gives you a lot of attenuation because they're highly fermentable. How much of a difference does the candy sugars make, and even the style of candy that you use beer? How big a flavor component is that?
Well, the tricky thing about this, so if you go back 15 years, if you went to, and I don't mean to pick on homebrew shops, but if you went to a homebrew shop and you bought something called candy sugar, that was not what they were using in Belgium. You know, they were creating clear cubes, or basically taking brown sugar, which no longer has those same unfermentables you get in a,
right. I mean, brown sugar is just a little molasses thrown in with sugar, I think, right?
Correct. And so you're getting that in cube form. So, you know, I having been in the brew house at West Flat Run, I tell you what they're doing for the most part is they've got this big bag of white sugar, just like you buy in the grocery store.
Okay.
And so that's for fermentability. And even in a dark beer, much of the sugar they use is still going to be that white sugar. There could be a choice of what sugar, but it's basically sugar. And there are people who like the idea of using invert sugar, which is actually more common to British brewing. But sugar is sugar. It ferments. That's why you're using it. It keeps your body lower. You don't want to get too high, obviously, but you can easily go to 10 to 15%. Now, in these dark beers, what the Belgians were using was confectionery sugar, which is leaving more, and which was really a syrup. And you can make your own syrup at home. Randy Mosher has a recipe in Radical Brewing, a slightly modified version in Brew Like a Monk. You can make that sugar at home. About the time Brew Like a Monk was coming out, that's when you had people start to import this confectionery sugar into the United States. And the question is what to call it. Originally, the idea is that syrup, but people think of that as candy with an I. So it got marketed as candy with an I. That's what it is in the United States. But certainly that is part of the flavor profile if you're doing a double or a dark strong. And the other part is mashing for attenuation.
Interesting.
So I think that might be your next question.
Yeah, well, yeah, we'll go into that in just a second. But on the sugar, so I mean, how much flavor are we really getting out? I mean, if it's table sugar, there's almost no flavor added, right?
Correct. You're not
confectionery adding sugar, almost no flavor added, right?
No. Well, the confectionery sugar is adding those dark flavors.
The dark. Okay.
So that's when you're going to get, you know, example now. You know, my takeaway.
You know, so when you say confectionery sugar, you're not talking about like powdered sugar. You're talking about something different, right?
Right. Yeah. Although it could be in powdered form. So this is something that was sold at like bakeries and candy makers in Belgium. And it's really better to think about in terms of making a syrup. When you make a syrup on the stove, you get that some Maillard reaction.
You caramelize it a little bit at least.
Right. It's a little caramelized. So that's the character that you're getting in the beer. And you're not going to get that with brown sugar. So that's the flavor element. And then also, as that it interacts with the yeast, that's when you get some more of the dark fruity character. And as it ages over time, that's when you get these more rich aromas and flavor. So having that dark syrup, whether it's called syrup or candy sugar, is vital to getting these flavors.
For the darker styles, yeah.
Right. And brown sugar won't get you there.
Yeah.
Brut Like a Monk comes out in 2005. I'm judging, at the time it was called NHC. Now it's Homebrew Con. And the Belgian strong category. And the winning beer turns out to be from Jamil Zanishoff. And I ask him for the recipe. And of course, from Brew Like a Monk, which I still do when I talk to people, I go, these are simple recipes. You don't need a whole lot in there. You can do a dark strong basically with Pilsner malt, white sugar, a fair amount of the syrup, and just tiny bits of dark grain, a certain amount of Munich. I love Belgian Special B. It's chew on it and eat it. You sure don't want to put a boatload of that in there. Mm-hmm. I say this, and I get his recipe.
It's in that harsh zone, yeah.
Yeah, but Jimmy L has like 8 different kinds of barley in there, a lot of dark grains, and he made a great beer. So it's not to say you can't accomplish these things, but the way the monks accomplish it is, I think it's easy to follow that and rather simple.
Yeah. And we're not all Jamil either.
Correct.
Let's talk. You mentioned mashing a minute ago. Let's talk about mashing schedules for high attenuation.
Well, again, the Belgian way is a step mash.
How many steps and what temperatures are they using?
About 3 steps. And I'd have to, I should have scribbled that down because it's maybe, I think there's maybe a quick one at 45, although that's going to give you, that's a ferulic acid rest. So maybe it's like 40, 50, 60, somewhere in there.
So they're doing kind of a barbell thing where you sort of hit a low mash temperature and a high mash temperature in the conversion step.
Right.
Which gives you a lot of attenuation. They use it a lot in lagers, right?
But you can accomplish the same thing at home or in a brewery. Given the modification of malts we have now, with just a single at about 146, which is about as low as most people feel comfortable going. And then don't mash out hop. So you're going to continue through your sparge to get conversion through the whole process. And you do that and you can easily get a beer that it's going to be like 0406.
So that's assuming a mash out. So again, you're doing kind of this thing where you kind of come in at 146 and then maybe, I don't know, 156 or something like that, right?
No, 146 and then right to whatever you mash out, but not super hot.
Yeah. So maybe it's 158. I don't know, but
I think I do it more like 170.
Well, that's the water you're putting in, but the grain never gets that hot. Right. So yeah. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Okay, well, moving on, you talked quite a bit about yeast. Is there anything unique about yeast other than yeah, we talked about quite a bit about the phenolics and so on. Is there anything unique about the yeast strains we're using?
Well, those are the strains. So if you look at you can compare I always forget the I mean, whether they're called high gravity, but the yeast strains that the origins come from Chimay, Westmall, Ashouf, Hoegaarden, any of those strains, they definitely have a lot of 4-VG, which is 4-vinyl glycol.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing that is in the German Hefe strains. And in fact, if you do a beer with no ferulic acid rest, which is about 115, you still get more 4-VG than you'll get in the German Hefe. So they are really prone to those phenolics, which is why a really good triple has that nice spicy note. And there's more, but you don't want to go too far into the clove, which is why I wouldn't advocate doing the ferulic acid rest, because you're still going to get it. But it's going to have more clove than you realize if you were to strip out all the esters. What happens is you're in balance. So when you get those higher alcohols and the esters, they're so prominent, just like the same reason you're going to have more IBU than you realize. So in a Hefe, where the alcohol is lower and you have a little in the way of hops, that's when you notice the clove character more. So you need to be careful that you don't let your beers get too clovey, which moves us the other part of fermentation is these beers.
Yeah, we
beers
can jump ahead and talk about, you know, what are you doing in fermentation to try and make this beer finish the way you want?
Well, you got to let it get warm, and it's willing to do that on itself. There are some questions about pitching rates in the book, and when I talk to people, you know, I'm showing you the pitching rates at Westmall, which are incredibly low. Rochefort makes really nice beer. So standard thinking is 1 mil per mil per P. So that would be
About two thirds of what you might normally use, maybe.
That's basically standard thinking. Okay. At a commercial level where they right. have greater ability. So it's tricky. Like Palmer would almost double that for a strong beer, you know, his feeling to be safe. And I tend to think it's fine to be over pitching as well. You will lose a little bit of the esters, if you over pitch, but you're a lot less chance you're going to strain your yeast and get a bunch of off flavors. So a good healthy pitch, I think, is fine.
Yeah.
And the other reason to do that is starting basically. So you'll see the recommended range from any yeast provider is don't let it get too warm. Because when people, their concern is if you see a range that says you can pitch between 68 or fermentation should be between 68 and 74, then people go, you know, if I pitch at 74, that's fine. Well, it's not fine. If you finish at 74, it's fine. But you need to be pitching at the low range. And if you pitch enough yeast, and it's real fermentable, so the yeast is happy in that environment to begin with, you can pitch at 64. It naturally is going to take your temperature rather quickly into the 70s, maybe even up to 80-ish. And you'll get a perfectly acceptable beer because it needs the higher temperature to finish. So what you're doing is you're not restraining the temp. And you also need to understand
it's kind of a free rise, huh?
It is a free rise.
Yeah.
And it's getting much. So if you use glass carboys, and you put a temperature stick on the outside. And you want this temperature preferably to be in an environment that is also about 64. So you put it, chest freezer, fridge, whatever, you put it in there where you're holding, the ambient temperature is 64. You're starting at 64. Within that carboy, it's going to heat up a lot, and it will, that strip on the outside will not reflect how warm it is getting. You can see that swirling around, and that's fine. And you're going to get, the simplest thing is to check your gravity along the way. You know, within 36 to 48 hours, you should be 80% towards your target. Mm-hmm. At that point, if it's getting warm, you are not going to get those same off flavors. So we live in New Mexico. We have floor heating. So if a beer wasn't quite finishing, I could, at that point, you know, say I'm 90% of the way, I could go in and put it in a warm spot on the floor just to heat it up a little bit and get it to that final gravity that I wanted. And, you know, that's, I mean, one of those beers I know I did with was a triple that won the Mountain Division or whatever, judging at Denver 1 year in the first round. So nice. Obviously had some nice flavors. So the thing is, think of your yeast as a partner, and your goal is to give it the best environment, the best work to work with, and then the best environment to work in. You are not controlling the yeast. You are understanding what the yeast wants. Yeah.
We skipped over hops a little bit, but hops, you know, obviously aren't dominant in this style, but you still have quite a bit of IBUs in many of these beers, right? Just to balance them.
Yeah. So they're generally not using a lot of flavor hops and not late hops. You're not looking for a lot of aroma, and you're using hops that would have been grown in that region. So those are land race varieties. They're going to be maybe a little bit citrus, floral, some spiciness to them. So you think of something like Saaz or Tettnanger. But you could also, I wouldn't use an American Grove Northern Brewer, but by the 1950s, Northern Brewer was a pretty important hop in Belgium once it became available, simply because it was easier to grow than the other stuff they had.
Well, you finished Brew Like a Monk back in 2005. What are some of the things in Belgium about Belgian styles that have either changed or you've learned since then?
Well, these, in terms of the beers in the book, why we haven't redone the book is very little has changed. What has changed is the availability of the dark syrup, so you know have that ingredient, and people recognizing that brown sugar is not going to cut it. Other than that, you know, the yeast strains are, there are more choices. There are more versions of the Westmalle yeast. If you have a particular preference. So within that family of beers, not as much has changed, but of course, like everywhere, you've got lots of new breweries, small brewers, and they're not standing still. So they may be leaning on, you know, De La Sin, my favorite, certainly leans on tradition, not having sweet beers, not having gimmicky beers, those sorts of things. But those beers are out there as well. So you've got a whole, just like here, small breweries doing something different. And then you've got our understanding that maybe beers people wouldn't have had. and that's the role of mixed fermentation, which they're doing there just as we're doing here, and certainly using saisons as a base for that.
Well, I just want to get your closing advice for anybody who's looking into starting to brew Belgian styles at home.
Well, that's in the introduction of the book, as I point out, this is not the book you start with. So, you know, read The Joy of Home Brewing or How to Brew, Palmer's book. So you need to know some basics going in. But the two parts, you can do this with a partial mash. And you can do that with rudimentary all grain. I think the thing is, and I think there are great lessons to be learned brewing these beers that will make your lagers better or your IPAs better or anything that you choose to brew, because it really, to do these beers well means that you have to understand the role of yeast and fermentation, and that it is simpler than that you might realize. Like I said before, if you understand that you're working for the yeast rather than you're taming the yeast.
Well, Stan, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you again for being here.
Well, I'm always happy to see that you're willing to invite me back.
Again, today my guest was Mr. Stan Hieronymus. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops, as well as Brewing Local and Brew Like a Monk. And I forgot to mention Brewing with Wheat. Stan, thank you again.
Well, thanks.
A big thank you to Stan Hieronymus for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch barge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the work clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the press system that I personally brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And I recently converted the BeersmithRecipes.com website to support mobile devices and also added the majority of the Beersmith brewing and unit conversion tools to the site. Subscribers to Beersmith 3 can access over 17 brewing tools online from any device, and anyone with an account can browse from tens of thousands of recipes. Visit BeersmithRecipes.com from your phone or computer to learn more. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.